10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and Morning Show co-host.
It is always exciting to catch up with one of the country's most celebrated sports writers, John Feinstein, who, of course, is also very, very well-known to many public radio listeners. I've had the great pleasure of speaking with John Feinstein on several previous occasions about an array of different fascinating books that he has written. His most recent is a book that I know must be very, very near and dear to his heart and is an exceptionally interesting and exciting book called The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. We are talking about three of college basketball's greatest legends, most legendary coaches who were at the University of North Carolina, Duke, and North Carolina State. Three schools very, very close to each other geographically, and all three in their heyday among the finest collegiate basketball powers in the country. And these three intriguing coaches were each striking in their own individual approach to the game and their relationships to one another. And John Feinstein knew them all, covering this beat very, very thoroughly, and wrote now a book that looks back on all three of them and sort of the peak of their intense three-way rivalry. Again, the book is called The Legends Club, and the book is published by Doubleday. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, good to talk to you again. Thanks.
So good to talk to you. And I know that you obviously understand the game of basketball and love it a lot. We've talked on at least two previous occasions about basketball-related books, although you don't limit yourself to the game of basketball. I can't remember asking you what your own personal connection to the game is. I mean, do you come to this as a former player?
I come to it as a failed player, Greg. I played right through junior high school, and I wasn't a terrible player at that level. But when I got to high school, the swimming coach at my school said to me, "Look, you're 5'4". You're not ever going to be that tall or that quick or that good. But if you kept it swimming, you could end up with a Division I scholarship someday." And as it turned out, he was right. I devoted myself to swimming, but never lost my love of basketball. I grew up going to games, college and pro, in Madison Square Garden constantly, and been played in the schoolyard forever. So I had a great love of the game, and then was fortunate enough to go to an ACC school. And you mentioned the geographic proximity of Duke, North Carolina, and NC State. Just try to imagine if Wisconsin, Ohio State, and Michigan were all in the same media market and all within a short drive of one another. And that's the way it was when I went to college in that area. And then I was lucky enough to get hired by the Washington Post and was covering the ACC when Jim Valvano arrived at NC State and Mike Krzyzewski arrived at Duke, both in 1980, within 9 days of one another, to try to challenge Dean Smith, who was already an iconic figure in the state. So when people ask me why this book, the answer is pretty simple. I wasn't born to write it, but I lived it, and probably knew all three of them better than anybody in the media ever did. I don't think that's an inaccurate statement, although it may be an immodest one.
Right. As maybe you've already mentioned, you went to Duke, one of the three colleges that we're talking about. And at some point, I was going to ask you about the whole matter of being relatively unbiased and as fair as possible, given that you obviously have a very special connection and loyalty to one of these three schools. I wasn't sure how to broach that question because I certainly don't want to insult your integrity as a sports writer, and particularly because, you know, in reading the book, it's clear you've been tremendously fair. And then I reread the introduction and realized here's my opening for asking the question, because that matter of being unbiased and fair actually came up all the way back in 1976 with your very first encounter with the legendary coach, Dean Smith. Tell us about that very initial exchange between the two of them and what he said about you and about your writing at a point when you were still just a student.
Yeah, I was a 19-year-old junior at Duke, and it's hard for people to believe now, but Duke was awful in basketball during that time. And I was working for the student newspaper, The Chronicle, and Duke played at North Carolina. They got crushed, which is what Duke was 1-10 against North Carolina during my 4 years there, just to give you some perspective. And but I was always a fan of Dean Smith. I remembered watching his teams play when I was a kid when they came into Madison Square Garden and watching them on TV. The ACC game of the week was always on in New York City. And I was writing a column about a guy who played for Duke named Tate Armstrong, who later played on Dean Smith's Olympic team that summer. And in those days, Dean used to kind of stand off in the corner of the locker room while it was open to the media post-game and after he had had his formal media session. And you could just kind of walk up to him one-on-one and get a couple minutes with him. So
those were the days.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thought of that happening in today's world is impossible. But I walked over, waited for a couple other guys, and very timidly introduced myself. You know, I said, my name's John Feinstein. I work for the student newspaper at Duke, The Chronicle. And he immediately said, oh, yes, I read the column you wrote last month about how Bill Foster, who was the Duke coach then, should follow our model to try to rebuild at Duke. I thought you were very fair, and then there was a pause, for someone from Duke. And I thought the column was more than fair for anybody, but I was more than that. I was awed that Dean Smith had read something I'd written in the Duke student newspaper. And I later found out, of course, that hit the North Carolina basketball office, because Dean never missed any detail, subscribed to the major national papers, all the ACC papers, and all the ACC student papers. And one of the assistant coaches, at one point it was Roy Williams, would clip the papers and find anything that was relevant, that he thought relevant for Dean to read on airplanes. So he had read the column. And, of course, that became kind of a running joke between Dean and I as I got to know him better when I graduated, that he would always say, yeah, you've always been fair to us, for someone from Duke. And I would always say, Dean, why can't you just say, I've been fair, period. Fair is fair. And it did become a joke with us for a long time. And I remember he was having a conversation once with much later in his life, this is 2009, with Lefty Driesell, and Dean and I had started work on a biography of him, and unfortunately his health had slipped to the point where we weren't able to complete it. But I was in his office one day, and Lefty Driesell called, and during the conversation he said to Dean, I can't believe you'd let a Duke guy write your biography. And of course Lefty went to Duke. Dean's response was, he's not a Duke guy, he's a good guy. And that was a crowning moment in my entire life.
And I assume by this point in time, by the time you got around to writing The Legends Club, in some respects, it's not even probably worth asking about the matter of being biased. I mean, you're a professional sports writer, and you owe it to yourself and your standing to write a fair, balanced account. I guess I'm really impressed that as a Duke student, you already knew something about balanced, fair writing. I mean,
well, I was lucky because the Chronicle was a great place to learn about journalism. It was totally student-run, and the older kids taught the younger kids, and I had very good teachers. In fact, two of my first editors at the Chronicle came to a book signing I did in Raleigh just the other night. They're still very close friends. But beyond that, what I have found throughout my career is, first of all, I think we all have biases, Greg. And the key is to be aware that you have biases. There are certain people you're going to like more than others. There are certain stories you're going to root for more than others. But what you do is you say, okay, I understand I have this bias. Let's make sure I'm fair. You use that word. That's the right word, fair. And And it was never a problem for me with these three because I liked them all and I respected them all. There's no person I ever respected more than Dean Smith. This was a guy who helped desegregate restaurants in Chapel Hill in the 1950s and always stood up for important social issues and was always somebody who was loyal through and through to his players. Krzyzewski, same way with his players and a good person, somebody who goes out of his way to help his friends, who's loyal to the nth degree. Valvano, maybe the single funniest and most entertaining person I've ever been around. Not maybe, he was. And someone I genuinely enjoyed being with. And so regardless of where they were coaching, I was always going to have respect for and like all three of them. And you're talking, you know, occasionally somebody will say to me, well, of course you like Krzyzewski because you went to Duke. No, I like Krzyzewski because he's Krzyzewski and because of who he is. And nobody can argue that Dean Smith and Mike Krzyzewski are two of the four coaches on Mount Rushmore for college coaching, along with Bob Knight and John Wooden. You pick your order, I don't care, but those are the four. And Valvano has this unique niche, A, because he was so extraordinary as a personality. He won a national title, and then, sadly, because of the way he died, you know, starting the V Foundation in the last months of his life, and that never-to-be-forgotten speech he made at the ESPYs, which was probably the only worthwhile moment that show's had in however many years they've been doing it. Hmm.
One thing you say towards the beginning of the book is that it's a good thing in terms of being able to write this book with the kind of thoroughness and completeness that you did, that you're a hoarder.
Yeah.
So tell our listeners in what respect you are a hoarder and in what way your hoarding was such a godsend when it came to being able to tell this story as you have.
Much to my wife's chagrin, I basically refuse to throw anything out. But specifically, I have never thrown out any of my tapes or notebooks from interviews I've done dating back to when I first started at the Washington Post in the late 1970s. And I knew when I first came to this idea that I wasn't going to be able to talk to Jim because he passed away in 1993, and I wasn't going to be able to talk to Dean at that point. He was in the last stages of dementia and unreachable in that sense. I did spend hours and hours with Krzyzewski, which was great. But I also knew two things. One, that somewhere in my basement were tapes and notebooks from the time I had spent with Dean and Jim through the years. And also, I have, at least at this moment, it could change next week, but at least at this moment, I have a very good memory. So I have some vivid recollections of being in Valvano's office at 3 in the morning when he would stretch out on the couch and say to me, what am I going to be when I grow up? Because he felt as if he had, quote, his words, done coaching after he won the national championship in 1983 at the age of 37. By the way, no other coach under the age of 40 has won a title since then. And so I knew I had those two things going for me. I also knew that I would be able to, or thought I would be able to, talk to their wives, Linnea and Smith and Pam Valvano, and they were extraordinarily helpful in fleshing some things out for me and telling me some things I didn't know at all. So I felt confident that I could write the kind of intimate book that I wanted to write because of all those things.
Right. I think in your acknowledgments, if I remember, you say it because two of these three titans had either had died or were close to death,
right,
at the time that you wrote it. You had to depend on the kindness of others. and of course, you ended up...
Nothing wrong with quoting Tennessee Williams.
Right, absolutely. Well, it's ended up being an absolutely tremendous book. One of the things that, of course, is so intriguing about these three great college basketball coaches is the sort of evolving relationship that existed between them, and also the sort of relative speed with which the two younger coaches ascended to greatness. You called one of them a hare and one of them a tortoise.
Right.
Explain that a bit.
Well, first of all, the evolving relationships, the way they did change, was kind of what brought me to the book, because as I say in the introduction, I was having a conversation with Krzyzewski during a dinner where he was receiving yet another coaching award, and he started telling me a story that I eventually recounted in the book about what turned out to be his final meeting with Dean and how emotional it was for him and how sad he was to see Dean in the condition he was in, but yet there was still a moment that meant lot to him. And he also talked about the last days with Valvano when he was visiting him in the hospital every day, every night after practice, and was actually in the room with him when he passed away. And I started thinking how different that was from what the relationships were when Jim and Mike first got to North Carolina. Mike's relationship with Dean was very hostile. Mike felt he had to go right in Dean's face to prove he wasn't intimidated by his iconic status, and it led to some real confrontations on the court, comments back and forth away from the court that went on for many years. And it was only later, ironically, when Mike ascended to what Dean had been and became the coach who was the target, became the coach who others said got all the calls, and there was a double standard for with officials, which Mike had felt about Dean earlier in his career, that he understood why Dean did some of the things he did and came to see him much more sympathetically and to respect him much more. Mike and Jim were peers. They were born 11 months apart. As I said, they arrived in North Carolina at almost the exact same time. So they were the two young guns trying to compete with the top gun when they got there. And as you said, Jim was the hare, you know, running out, winning the national title, becoming a rock star in 1983 because of it and because of his unique personality. And Mike was kind of plodding along, getting a lot of flack from Duke people. He was 38 and 47 his first three seasons. Most Duke boosters wanted him fired. Tom Butters, the athletic director who hired him and stood by him through that period, has a box in his house that contains letters, and some of them are from 1983 demanding that he fire Krzyzewski, and some of them are from 1990 telling him you pay him whatever you have to pay him to make sure he doesn't leave. And they're all from the same people. So that's how things changed in a 7-year period, because Krzyzewski got the program rolling starting in 1986. But, Jim did run out in front, and Mike did eventually, ironically, run both he and Dean down, and at least in terms of numbers, surpass both of them.
By the way, I don't know if you can take credit for it, but I sure love that headline in the student newspaper after Coach Krzyzewski was hired.
No, Krzyzewski. I don't take credit for it. I had graduated. I was already working.
Oh, that's right.
At that point.
But the headline is
great headline.
Yeah, Krzyzewski. This is not a typo, because any name that's Krzyzewski looks like somebody just sort of fell asleep on their keyboard. But
that and the fact that nobody thought that Tom Butters would hire a coach from Army who had just gone 9-17 to be the coach at Duke. But he did it, and it turned out to be a pretty good decision.
Here's the last question. What do you attribute the fact that these three schools, in such incredible proximity to one another, achieved such splendid greatness simultaneously? Is it just that they each managed to attract such fine coaches, or is there something else about sort of the culture and landscape that it makes sense somehow for three such impressive basketball powers to be right down the road from each other?
I think it's a combination of the two. If you go back to when the three became basketball powers, North Carolina won the national championship in 1957. NC State was a power throughout the 60s and 70s. Duke was a power in the 60s and then fell for a brief period of time. During that time, there were no professional sports teams in the state of North Carolina. Now, you know, you have the football team in Charlotte, you have the basketball team in Charlotte, and a hockey team in Raleigh. But back then, the college basketball teams in particular were the thing to do, the popular thing, because none of the schools were really very good in football. They had brief spasms, but none of them were like the SEC is today or the Big Ten. College basketball was it. It was part of the culture. And when you were recruited there as a player, you knew that you were going to be king of the hill during the time that you were playing there, and that was attractive to a lot of players. But also it was the coaches. I mean, if you go back to Everett Case at North Carolina State, who came from Indiana to build the program there, Frank McGuire, who came from New York to build the program at North Carolina. Vic Bubas, ironically, went to NC State and built the program at Duke. And that set the stage then for Dean Smith to come in, for Mike Krzyzewski to come in, for Jim Valvano to come in, and later, you know, much later for Roy Williams in the last 12 years to succeed as he has at North Carolina. So I think it's a combination of the culture and then the tradition that was built up during that period and the fact that they've continued to have great coaches.
Hmm. Well, three of the best are examined in almost breathtaking detail in your wonderful new book, again, which is called The Legends Club. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Lovano, and an epic college basketball rivalry, published by Doubleday, and the author, John Feinstein. John Feinstein, you've done it again. Thank you for writing yet another remarkable book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Greg, it's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
And for part two of the morning show, we should point out Gregory is off today. So for part two, he asked me to pull something out of the archives that I would find interesting. He played this interview last week, and it was an interview that he replayed. It's a book called The 27 Club, and it examines the intriguing aspect of rock music where a number of rock superstars have died at the age of 27, including Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison from The Doors, Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. It's a very, very intriguing subject. So we're going to play a portion of the interview to fill out part two of the morning show. Once again, the book is called The 27 Club.
Can we at first talk about what has led you to be so interested in the lives of artists and especially musicians? Is that a lifelong interest? And at what point did you find yourself devoting so much of your time and energy professionally to exploring their lives?
Well, I'm primarily interested in, I guess, personalities, people who are psychologically interesting. And I've written about different types of people. I wrote a biography of Charles Bukowski, the writer. I've written about crime. I've written about sportsmen and three books about musicians. But the common denominator for me is that they're all really interesting people. And also, I try to write about people whose work I admire. And I was a great admirer of Amy Winehouse, who has this image as a sort of drunken, sort of rather foolish person, but she was a terrific songwriter, a really talented songwriter, and a tragic person. And her demise 2 years ago led me down this path of investigating the lives of other great stars who happened to have died at the same age, which has become such a phenomenon.
As I read your book, well, first of all, regarding Amy Winehouse, I realized really for the first time how harshly and unkindly I had regarded her and her story. I mean, from a musical point of view, she meant absolutely nothing to me. I mean, I'd never heard any of her songs. I wasn't interested in her as a musician in the way that, you know, not everybody's interested in every kind of music. But she did sort of fascinate me as this tragic and mostly to me very pathetic figure, and I only realized upon reading your book that I really had allowed myself to view her only as, in a sense, kind of a laughing stock or as a sort of a warning to others about how not to live your life. And you, through your book, you help us see her as a human being, which in one respect is a very painful thing, because it makes her demise, in a sense, much sadder for us than if we're just viewing it from a very much an emotional distance. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if anybody else has said that about your book, that it allows us to feel pain on behalf of these figures for whom maybe we only saw them with derision before.
Yes, I mean, I think you have to care about these people, and I cared about them, writing about them, and I took them seriously and treated their lives and their deaths with respect. So they're not joke figures to me. Some are more likable than others. I personally thought that Amy was very, very talented, a very great songwriter, a tremendous singer, a true original, actually, a very original artist, and she was also a very likable person, very clever, stylish, unusual, rather brave and bold, and the drunkenness was desperately sad, and that really was a symptom of a very unhappy life. But she was nevertheless an extremely talented and singular artist, one of the greatest that have come along for many years. And her one great album, Back to Black, is absolutely knockout, 5 stars. You know, if you haven't got it, go and get it. It's absolutely wonderful, and it's a record of deep personal pain. And I hope in the book that the readers go beyond the image and they see really Amy as she was, tremendously talented young lady whose life was troubled right from the start. And that's really what the book is about. We see that all these artists had very difficult early lives, and they were in trouble before they became famous, and fame only made things more difficult because they didn't cope well with sudden success, wealth, and the pressure that comes with success.
Hmm. Another general comment I want to make about your book, and I also very much appreciated this, is that you, as you've already indicated, are writing with respect and in some cases certainly with affection about these musicians. I mean, you are looking at them and looking at their lives in a rather kind way, and certainly in a fair way. And on the other hand, I feel like you do not go so far as to excuse them for their self-destructiveness. I mean, you don't entirely lay the blame at the doorstep of others who may have failed them in one way or another. I mean, I think you, at least that's the way I read this book, you really achieve a very interesting and I should think uncommon balance here in regarding them kindly and humanely, and yet at the same time not excusing them for some terribly foolish, self-destructive choices, which all of these people made. Can you just talk about that a moment, and whether or not that was something with which you really sort of consciously wrestled, that balancing act?
Well, I think whenever you write about people, you owe it to them to be honest and fair, especially if they're dead, they can't answer back. And so much nonsense has been written about these people, so much of that is frankly untrue and ridiculous. Conspiracy theories that the mafia killed them, that they died in all sorts of, there's all sorts of bizarre explanations for how they died. There's so much dishonest journalism and dishonest books, frankly, written about these people, that I thought it was refreshing to simply set out the facts of their lives, and also to remind the readers that they were really terrifically talented people. And of course, like all of us, you know, they had frailties. Their frailties were more pronounced than most of us, and I think they were all self-destructive to a point of actually killing themselves, which is a rather bold statement. Only one of them has suicide on their death certificate, and that is Kurt Cobain, who shot himself. But actually, when you look at the trajectory of these 6 lives, they all killed themselves in the sense that they abused drink and drugs, and they abused their bodies, their health, to the point where death was very, very likely, if not inevitable. And that's rather a hard thing to face up to if you're a fan of these people, because you don't like to think that your hero was so unhappy, was so mentally messed up, that they wanted to die. And that, I think, is the truth of the matter. It's no accident that Amy Winehouse died. She wanted to die. And I think that the same is true of all of these people to a degree. That's really a very, very, very dark story, very challenging story, and that's the story that we build up to through the book. We start in childhood, and we see how life starts and how it goes a bit wrong, and indeed as it also goes right, because all these people get very lucky as well. They're both lucky and unlucky. But then the second part of the book, which is about their last days and death, we see this sort of common downward path, this sort of they're all running headlong into the arms of death, with a capital D, and that's really a very shocking, common story.
Mm. We're speaking with Howard Soons about his book 27, A History of the 27 Club, through the lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. You say this towards the very beginning of the book. The 27 Club is essentially a media construct based on a coincidence. It is also a flippant, even vulgar term. Nevertheless, the phrase is widely used and understood, and these deaths are intriguing. The question is, are there common factors apart from coincidence that help explain the death of Amy Winehouse and the five major rock stars who died before her at the age of 27? You go on from there to explore, which is kind of an intriguing matter, of whether or not there really should be something called the 27 Club, or if in fact young artists die all the time at tragically young ages, and some of them die at 27, some die at 26, 29, whatever. Tell us a little more about what you discovered as you sort of numerically explored this notion of the 27 Club.
Yeah, well, the 27 Club is indeed a sort of media invention, and it came about because a number of very big names happened to die at the same age, and over the years this became very apparent, and journalists started to write about it, and by the time that Kurt Cobain died in 1994, it was such a prevalent concept that his mother, the day he died indeed, said to a reporter, "He's gone and joined that stupid club. I told him not to." So by this stage, everybody knows that there is this notional club of rock stars who died at the same age. Now, the first thing to do, writing about this club, is to examine the facts. You know, how unusual is it to die at 27 if you're a musician? So what I did at the beginning of the book, I did a survey of over 3,000 musicians who died over a period of 100 years, and I made this into a graph, just to see what the peak age of death was and how the graph revealed the numbers. And of course, most musicians die actually in middle age, late middle age. 61 is the peak age, and the graph builds up, and then it goes down, as you would imagine, as people reach that age, they're more likely to die, and less people die in very old age because there's less of them around. But right at the start, there is this spiking in numbers at 27. There is a spike. 50 people actually died at age 27, which is quite a dramatic spike in the early part of the graph. And there's lots of reasons for that, actually. There's quite complicated reasons. But then what I did is I took those 50 people and I looked at their lives. I picked out the six most famous and compared their lives. So that was my methodology.
I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of probing into the lives of people like this. And first of all, we're of course talking about some musicians who died a fairly long time ago. I mean, maybe died 45 years ago. And so a fair amount of time has elapsed, and probably even at the time there was enough chaos surrounding their lives that even in the moment or in the immediate aftermath of their deaths, it might have been difficult to trace certain storylines with great certainty. And even now, even when with something as recent as Amy Winehouse, I mean, to whom do you speak? To whom can you trust in terms of who's going to give the clearest and most truthful account of what happened to her and why? Can you just say a kind of a general word about the challenge of writing about people living lives like this, and particularly in trying to trace their each demise?
Well, my books are all based on original research, which means to say that apart from, of course, reading everything that's been written before in books and in newspapers, I then go out and I try to speak to all the living witnesses I can get to, and I find whatever official reports there may be, autopsy reports, death certificates, police reports. And I go to the various places involved in the story, so I would go to wherever the people lived and died and try to somehow absorb the atmosphere of the place so I can write about it with some originality. So my books, 27, is like my previous books about Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan and Charles Bukowski and the books I've written about crime, in that they're based on original research, which is actually very difficult to do, by the way. It's a rather painstaking and difficult task. Not everyone wants to speak to you. Not everybody is around. You know, a lot of people are now dead, especially when you go back to the 60s. But if you're if you persevere and you plug away, you can find friends and, you know, former lovers and bandmates and members of the family who will give you a perspective which brings a freshness to the story. Now, they don't all tell the truth. That's one of the problems you face. People lie, and they dissemble, and they cover up. And that's one of the themes in this book, that we find the 27s are often surrounded by people who frankly aren't very reliable and exploit them. And that's a real theme in the story, a very unhappy theme. And that's true of investigating their lives, that you find these people who are obstructive and dishonest and they have their own agendas. But other people are honest and frank, and you have to piece together all this evidence and not neglect the actual written evidence, i.e. the official files. If there was an autopsy, what is the coroner's report? What is the police report? What does the death certificate say? And I try to base my work on these findings rather than go off into the realm of fantasy, where with conspiracy theories and the like, of which there's been so many with these people. And some of them are really, really ridiculous. So it's all based on hard facts, as far as I can find hard facts, and it's based on original interviews. And then, of course, in my own mind, I have to work all this stuff out and come up with what I really believe to be true. So at the end of the day, it's my take on the whole thing, but it's based on original information.
Right. And just now as you were speaking, I began to put something together in my mind for the very first time. And it reminded me of something that, again, comes from early in the book when you write, throughout the story of the 27 Club, there is reluctance on the part of family members, friends, and fans to accept that such talented young people died in wretched and often banal circumstances. To suggest that they died because of their own foolishness is taken as an insult. It is even more egregious to suggest that they wanted to die. And you just mentioned the conspiracy theories that spring up. I just completed an interview about John F. Kennedy, and the 50th anniversary of his assassination is coming up, and this guest made the point that because for many people JFK is a figure straight out of Camelot, that to them it is so offensive, inconceivable, that just one troubled lone gunman could bring all that crashing to the ground. And that is what fuels the incessant, persistent conspiracy theories around JFK's assassination, the fact that that is a way for people to make sense of something so senseless. And what you're describing with some of the people who were closest to these artists is that also for them, and maybe for many of their fans, they just simply don't want to accept that people with such gifts, with such promise, could come to this kind of sad, pathetic end.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true, yeah.
Let's talk about the experience of probing into the childhood of each of these artists. You say that's one thing that they have in common, unhappy childhoods, although at one point you ultimately draw a distinction between Amy Winehouse and the other five in terms of the amount of contact with their families. But were these unhappy childhoods very much in the same way, or did that unhappiness play out in very different fashion for each of them?
Some of them just didn't get along with their parents. That's quite common. Of course, that's common with teenagers the world over, but it's quite marked with the 27s. And what is also very marked is situations where parents break up and separate, divorce, when the children are at a very impressionable age. Now, Kurt Cobain, who was perhaps one of the more articulate and intellectual of these people, actually, he was very much prone to self-analysis, and he blamed his problems, his psychological problems, which were the basis of his drug problem and eventually his suicide, he blamed all that squarely on one key event in his early life, and that was when his parents separated and divorced very acrimoniously, hating each other, blaming each other, having scenes in front of the children, very upsetting domestic arguments when he was a young boy. And this was the key turning point in his life. And actually, I was then rather amazed to find that at the exact same age, this happened to Kurt Cobain, The same thing happened to Amy Winehouse. Her dad left home for a younger woman, completely selfish reasons. It wasn't an acrimonious divorce like Kurt Cobain's parents, but dad essentially abandoned the family. You know, and that leaves kids with a great feeling of, you know, was it something that I did? That's the typical response of kids whose parents break up. Is it my fault? And that leads to all sorts of problems. Jimi Hendrix's parents fought like cat and dog. Jim Morrison disliked his parents so intensely that he refused to speak to them in latter life. And when they tried to see him, come to see him at his concerts, he snubbed them. He wouldn't take their phone calls. He absolutely loathed them. Brian Jones also had a very difficult relationship with his parents. And Janis Joplin. So it's common to all of them that they had these very difficult, unhappy relationships with their parents.
What you, the distinction you draw, I believe, with Amy Winehouse is that basically with the other five, they essentially divorced themselves from their parents. I mean, had almost no contact whatsoever, or what very little contact there was strained and unhappy. But that, in fact, Amy Winehouse did not distance herself from her own family in quite the same way, although you also quite rightly point out that in maintaining close ties with her father, that led to some other problems.
Well, yeah, her dad became... No, you're quite right. She was close to her parents for the rest of her life. But she seemed to forgive her dad for abandoning the family. And indeed, her dad became very, very active in her life. He became a kind of manager, really, which is a rather curious aspect of her story. And I don't think her father comes out of it very well. He frankly became a little bit too busy in her career, and one wonders what his motivation was, really. I think he enjoyed... To put the matter gently, he enjoyed the limelight as much as she did, or maybe a little bit more than she did. He wanted to be a performer himself, her father, and I think he was living vicariously through her success, and he became a celebrity by association with his daughter. And when she died, as in the case of many of these people, it's the parents who end up getting rich because, you know, he became a millionaire as a result of her death. So the family story is complicated and unhappy, actually, with all of these people. It's really not a very edifying story.
Mm. And you tell the story of how, in so many cases, and as you've already touched on this, how artists have often found themselves surrounded by a circle of admirers and collaborators who end up being ultimately very disruptive presence in their lives. And in the case specifically of Kurt Cobain and Amy Winehouse, you say that once they had found their voices, their rise to the top was rapid, and in becoming celebrities, they took up with partners who shared their weaknesses, which exacerbated their problems. That's probably a very common problem that often plays out far away from the spotlight and in the lives of just everyday people. But, of course, for these artists and their lives in the spotlight, it's a story that we sort of follow with interest and ultimately with horror. Tell us about these partnerships that were so ultimately damaging, particularly to these two.
Well, Amy Winehouse and Kurt Cobain did almost exactly the same thing. They both took up with fellow drug users, so Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, and Amy Winehouse and a man called Blake Fielder Civil. And indeed, they married these people. And these were people who abused drugs as they abused drugs. So these were marriages, love affairs based on the use of narcotics. And Courtney and Blake are not particularly sympathetic characters. You know, one shouldn't blame them for what happened, but they were not strong people. Well, I think Courtney Love is a very strong person in some respects, but she's not somebody who is necessarily supportive, not somebody who was the best person to marry Kurt Cobain. I think they made each other worse. They exacerbated each other's problems. And then, of course, you know, broaden this out a little bit. Look at Jim Morrison. Now, he lived with a woman called Pamela Corson, and who was with him when he died. Now, she was a heroin user, as he was. And the reason there's been so much mystery about the death of Jim Morrison in Paris in 1971 is, quite frankly, that Pamela Corson lied to the police about what happened. And she lied to the French police about what happened because she was a heroin user and she was terrified of getting herself into trouble. And so she didn't tell them the truth. And then look at Jimi Hendrix, who died here in London. I'm speaking to you from London. He died here in 1970. Now, he died in the hotel room of a woman who's also now dead, who was a drug abuser and was also dishonest. Was just a liar. She lied about what happened to Jimmy in his last hours. And then Brian Jones also spent his last hours with somebody who is less than reliable. So this is a very common. This runs through the story that these people, you know, they are themselves psychologically weak people who are prone to bad habits, and they tend to hook up with likewise people, and that's a bad combination.
Is that also some kind of a combination that contributes to their success and to their fame, or do they achieve their fame, whatever artistic greatness they achieve, and then this happens to them? I mean, is there any way in which the characteristics you just described, which ultimately lead to their demise, are an ingredient in what propels their success?
Well, it is to a degree, because, of course, it's part of the psychodrama of their lives, which is part of the image, of course. But much more importantly, in Amy Winehouse's case, for instance, her one great album, she only made two albums. The first one is kind of so-so, but the second one, Back to Black, is the classic. Well, what is Back to Black about? It's all about her unhappy love affair, her tempestuous love affair with this man, Blake Fielder Civil, who was a drug user, the man she married. And it's all about how, you know, they are lovers, and then they break up, and she's heartbroken and bereft and wants to die. And it's all about those emotions. And, of course, so Blake is, in fact, the inspiration for this great work of art. And, indeed, look at Janis Joplin, whose work was based upon, you know, anguish and her emotional problems, often with men. Now, she wasn't a great songwriter like Amy Winehouse, but she was certainly a great singer and performer. And her performances were performances of anguish, an anguished woman like Edith Piaf and Judy Garland and so many others through history, Billie Holiday. And so the personal life informs the work, very much so, and very much so with Amy Winehouse, who was such a great songwriter. And really, if you look at the lyrics on Back to Black, she writes about the experience of an unhappy love affair with enormous insight and passion.
This reminds me of something you say at the end of chapter one of your book, in talking about the presence of adversity and pain in the lives of these particular musicians and others. You write at one point, in a sense, we should thank the parents of the 27s, inadequate as many were, for creating an environment conducive to artists. If mommy and daddy had provided happier homes, their sons and daughters might have passed in anonymity. They might still be alive, but who would have heard of the optometrist Brian Jones, assuming he had followed the career his parents envisioned? Who would have known Jimi Hendrix, landscape gardener, or care about Janis Joplin, Port Arthur housewife, who would read the sociologist Jim Morrison, or give a damn about school janitor Kurt Cobain? As for Amy Winehouse, she worked briefly as a reporter before going into show business, and might have been in journalism still, had her background and character been different.
The book is called The 27 Club, and Greg Berg should be back tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. Coming up on 8:59, quick reminder, support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and morning show co-host. Right now, 59 degrees, 5-9 across the board for Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Cloudy, breezy, and warm. The forecast with a high today of 63. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. And we will join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming at 9 o'clock.